I had a song that I was thinking about playing for you today, and I decided not to. And the more I thought about it, the more I was trying to figure out, like, why I decided not to. And here's why. You know that a couple of times in the past, I've, like played a song and then just talked about the song. And the song that I was thinking about playing would go along really well with what I was talking about. Like I said, I decided not to do it. And then we sang a song this morning by Keith Green, and Keith Green was the one who would have been singing the song that I would have played for you. Okay, so the reason I decided not to do it is because one time when I did play a song, afterwards somebody came up to me and said, "Why did you play that song? That was really dumb." Or words to that effect, you know. And so I'm like, "I don't know. Maybe it was dumb." So that's why I chose not to play this song. So my question for you is, how many of you think it's really dumb if I were to play a song in the middle of my speaking? Okay. Maybe next Sunday, if I can fit it in, I'll play you the song. It's kind of a humorous song, and it would have gone along really well with what I was talking about today. Okay, so it's amazing how much one comment affects how you move forward. Like, someone finds fault with you about one little tiny thing, and you're like, "Oh, I'm never doing that again." Even though, like, 90% of the people are like, "Oh, that was really cool." One person really affects you. Okay, anyhow, moving on from that. So we have been talking about the time that Jesus spent in the desert being tempted, tested by the devil. And we're up to number 3. And I'm going to do a quick review just so that we can keep kind of the thread going through of what we're talking about. So what happened was, Jesus was baptized by John the Baptizer, and a voice was heard saying, "This is my son." So moving forward, what's at question here is the sonship of Jesus, Jesus as God's son. So he got baptized. The voice said, God said from heaven, "This is my son." And then the first thing he did was went out into the desert. And he was in the desert for 40 days. And the whole 40 days he was wrestling with Satan. And at the end, we have record here of 3 specific testings that Jesus went through. So the devil came to him and said, "If you are the son of God," this could also be understood as "since you are the son of God," or "because you are the son of God." Because you are the son of God, you should be able to do this one thing. Okay? So the first one was, turn those stones into bread. So yeah, you're hungry because you haven't eaten for 40 days. Because you're the son of God, why don't you turn the stones to bread, and that'll take care of your problem. So Jesus answered that from a period of Israel's history when they were wandering around in the desert. And his answer shows that being the son of God is not using your power to take care of yourself, to protect yourself, to build up your own personal peace and prosperity, to take a phrase from Francis Schaeffer. But Jesus defines sonship as dependence on God to take care of you. And then the second one is, at least in Luke, the second one is giving of empire power. Satan offered Jesus empire power. And again, Jesus answers from Israel's time in the desert that he will not do that. And he redefines power as fearing and serving God alone. So then Satan says to him, "Because you are the son of God, why don't you throw yourself down from the pinnacle of the temple?" So that is where we were last Sunday. We got halfway through that. And so now we're going to finish this one up. So I'm going to read to you from Luke 8:12. So this is the sheet of paper that doesn't have anything on the back. It's just like the one-sided paper. Okay, so then he brought him to Jerusalem, set him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said to him, "If you are the son of God, throw yourself down from here. For it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you to keep you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone." So here we have the devil quoting to Jesus Psalm 92. And last time I spoke, we looked very deeply at Psalm 92 to try to figure out exactly what it meant. And what it doesn't mean is that God will protect all righteous people from all bad things all of the time. And the example that I gave last time was the story of the five missionaries in Ecuador. I could have just as easily shown you the story of Keith Green's life and death. As Janae read to us, he was killed very tragically in a plane crash at the height of his career, and he was one of the most influential musicians in Christian music at the time, very prolific, and went around to universities and had a really good rapport with university students and had a huge, huge ministry. And then, of course, Last Days Ministries was also a very big deal in the late 70s, early 80s. So why? Why in the world did that happen to him? You know, we don't know. God does not promise to protect all righteous people from all bad things all of the time. But the underlying promise is still there. God's angels will bear you up. If you're in a situation, God's angels are going to be there with you. So I briefly touched on the three understandings of Psalm 92. From the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have discovered that one of the understandings at the time of Jesus was that this was a psalm about protection against Satan and his demons. Jesus pointedly does not discuss the irony of Satan quoting this particular psalm to him. He skips right over that part. Another understanding at the time was that this is messianic protection. The Messiah will be protected in this particular manner. And this had really gotten into the theology of the Jews at the time. I talked to you about Simon the Sorcerer, the guy that we met in Acts, and the guy that believed his own press about what a great guy he was and how he built an edifice and jumped from it, hoping to prove that he was going to be the Messiah, ended up not being the Messiah, ended up dying from his injuries from that. So there's also a couple of other stories about the people's idea of the messianic expectation for the time. There is a Midrash writing, which is like a commentary on the Hebrew Scriptures. And in that writing, this writing actually was written a little bit after Jesus' time, but in this writing, the rabbi says that the idea is that the Messiah is going to come and stand on the high point of the temple. So this would be like we would call the pinnacle of the temple. They call it the wing of the temple. The Messiah will appear on the wing of the temple. If you remember Psalm 92, in the shadow of your wing, the Messiah will be protected. So, and that's where every eye will see him when he comes to this wing of the temple. And of course, then the temple was destroyed. But when the temple was destroyed, there was a guy, another Simon. There's like 17 Simons in this very small portion of history in Israel. So Simon Bar Giora, he is a leader of the revolt against Rome. And he was at the temple to the very last. And he was captured at the temple and taken off to Rome, and horrible things happened to him. But here's what he did based on his understanding of the messianic protections. When he realized that the Romans were going to overrun the temple and destroy it, he had tunnels built so that people could escape from Jerusalem. And then he donned a white robe and a white headdress, and he went through the rubble of the temple until he got to the highest point of the pile of rubble, and he climbed up and he stood on the high point in these white robes. And the idea behind this was the Romans would understand that this was supposed to be the Messiah, and they would be frightened and possibly run off. The Jews and his fighting force would see this and interpret it as the Messiah was here and would be encouraged to continue fighting. So this is how deep the idea of this Psalm 92 is, messianic protection. This is how deep it went. It did not work. The Romans overran Jerusalem And as I said, bad things happened to the people who were the leaders of the revolt. So there is a third understanding, and this is as God's protection of Israel in the desert at the time that they were moving from Egypt to their promised land. This is the idea that Jesus engages with Satan. So I read to you Luke 4, 8 through 11, and now I'm going to read 12. And Jesus answered and said to him, "It has been said, you shall not tempt the Lord your God." Okay, so he is quoting from Deuteronomy 6, 16 through 19. If you follow across the page there at the bottom, this is what Deuteronomy 6 says. "You shall not tempt the Lord your God as you tempted him in Massah. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, his testimonies and his statutes which he has commanded you, and you shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you, and that you may go in and possess the good land of which the Lord swore to your fathers." Okay, so here's the quote. "You shall not tempt the Lord your God as you tempted him in Massah." Okay, so what happened at Massah that we're not supposed to do, that Jesus is not supposed to do, that the Israelites weren't supposed to do, and then again, you know, coming up to our life? It seems like it might be kind of important for us to understand this. So we have seen, and I have talked about other testings that we see in the Bible. One of these is Gideon, when God told Gideon to go to battle. Gideon was like, "Really? I'm not sure about this. You're going to have to prove it to me that this is really you telling me to go to battle." And God did. God didn't have a problem with that. Hezekiah asks God to prove Isaiah's prophecy that he's going to get well, and God did. He didn't have a problem with that. Zechariah, when John the Baptist was getting ready to be born, he asked the angel for proof of what the angel said. God was okay with that. Okay, so what's God not okay with? I'm going to tell you a little story from Ted's life. When he was trying to decide whether to come to Alaska, a friend of his had told Solid Rock that this guy would make a good counselor. So Bert at Solid Rock contacted Ted and said, "Hey, you want to be a counselor?" And Ted said no. But he just couldn't get out of his mind the idea of coming to Alaska. Maybe he was supposed to, maybe God wanted him to. So his two options were either come to Alaska, be a counselor at Solid Rock, and then go back. He didn't know he was going to meet me and his life was going to be changed. So, or if he would not have come here, he had just won a national race by like 35 seconds, which is a huge margin, right? And all of a sudden his coaches were looking at his running performance and saying, "Okay, the Olympic trials are coming up." So he was invited to join the team that was training for the Olympic trials. So that would have been in the summer of 76. Also, he was going to Bible school, came from a very poor family, so he was paying his own way through Bible school, and so he worked full time at Fred Meyer's for like $2.35 an hour to get enough money to go to Bible school. So either come to Solid Rock and be a counselor, or stay in Oregon, be on the Olympic trials team, and work to make enough money to go to Bible school. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's much to choose from that. So he was struggling with that, and one night he prayed and said, "God, I've decided that I'm not going to go to Alaska. I'm going to stay here, but I want to do your will. So if that's the wrong decision, please let me know." Okay. So that night, for 3 o'clock in the morning, he was driving home from his job at Fred Meyer's, and a drunk driver crossed the line and hit another car and then his car head on at about 75 miles an hour. He ended up in the hospital with a back injury. He couldn't run. He couldn't go back to work. And there he just was. And he said what he thought as he was laying there in the hospital, "Okay, God, I'll go. I'll go." So he did. He came. And who knows, you know, what would have happened. So that was okay with God. God was okay with saying, you know, with this test, "Here's my decision, but can you change? Can you change it if you need to?" Right? So what happened at Massah to prompt this idea of not testing God. That's what we're going to take a look at. We're going to go to Exodus. So on your second sheet of paper, Exodus is on the back of the colored part. We're going to go through what the children of Israel are doing that leads up to this idea of what happened at Massa. So Exodus 14. This takes place as the Israelites are trapped at the edge of the Red Sea. Pharaoh's army is coming at them from the desert, and they're lined up on the edge of the Red Sea watching Pharaoh's army come, and they can't go anywhere, and they can't do anything. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone. Let us serve the Egyptians.' It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Okay, so do you see this attitude that we have here? They're saying to God, "Leave us alone. God, we do not want to have a relationship with you. We would rather be in Egypt serving the other gods than to have you put us in this situation. We don't want you," is what they're saying here. Okay, but then the miracle happens. Then the Red Sea opens, they cross, they're safe, and God brings them to an oasis. This oasis had like 72 palm trees and 12 springs, and so there they are, and it's a great place to be. But then God says, "We're not staying here. We're going out across the desert." So they began their trek across the desert. And this is Exodus 16, now 2-3. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Okay, what they're saying to God here. We would have preferred to stay in Egypt. They refused to acknowledge that God was in the middle of a saving act for them, the rescue from Egypt. Okay, so this is the point where God gives them manna and quail. All right, so then Exodus 17, God led them to the next step. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin. Incidentally, this is kind of like a sidebar here. The desert of sin, that word sin does not mean what you think it means. This is a place, actually. So this is not an allegory like you read Pilgrim's Progress and you have like the celestial city and the Slough of Despond and those kind of places. This is not what this is. The desert of sin is not an allegorical place. Okay, this is an Egyptian town spelled C-Y-I-N, and it's pronounced Sin. So if you ever read that about the desert of sin, don't get the idea that this is just like they're wandering around and they're sinning, and so the desert is called the desert of sin, not how it goes. Okay, anyhow, so they set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" Do you see a theme in the grumbling? We would rather be dead than being taken care of by you. We do not want a relationship with you. We were better off back in slavery, back worshiping the idols, better off dead in Egypt than here in the desert with you. Exodus 17, 4 through 7. Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me." The Lord answered Moses, "Go out in front of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called this place Massa and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not? If God is here, let him prove it." So this all happened before the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. So far in this desert journey, what God is trying to do with his people is show them his character. So they have been in Egypt for a long time, 4 generations, I think it is. They don't know who God is. And so God has brought them in the desert and he's showing them who he is. I have this power. I can do these things. I can take care of you. I can save you. And they are continually asking him to prove that that's what his character is. And they are, each time he does it, they reject what he does. That's not good enough. So this is the attitude that they have here that culminates at Massa with the striking of the rock for the water. So we're going to look now, turn your page over, at Psalm 78. Psalm 78 is a psalm that interprets what went wrong at Massa. This was written by Asaph, and it was written in David's time, so this is a look back. This particular psalm looks back on the desert wanderings and all the way up to when the Israelites actually took over their promised land. And what you see in Psalm 78, and it's a super long psalm. I don't remember how many, like 75 verses or something. So obviously we're not going to look at all 75 verses. But what you see in this psalm is an intertwining of 3 different themes, just in and out, back and forth. And I have color-coded them for you so you can see just in these excerpts. And this is what they are. I have left out, just this is full disclosure here, I have left out some verses just because we can't look at all of them. But the ones I put in here are the ones that show what this intertwining of these themes are. There's the themes of testing or testimony, which are kind of the same thing, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. There are descriptions of Israelites' rejection of God, and there are descriptions of God's saving act, his rescue from Egypt and his care in the desert. So we're going to look at some of these, which culminates, like I said, in Massa and the idea there. So let's look at the greens are the testing, the idea of the Israelites testing God. The blues are the description of their rejection of God. And then the reds are the description of God's saving acts to them. So that's what we have here. So the Lord has established a testimony in Jacob. He has appointed a law in Israel. Okay, so this testimony that they're talking about, that God is establishing with Jacob and Israel, is witnesses. It's the same word for witnesses. And what's happening here is God is giving them witnesses of his character. He's setting up a test, and then he's passing the test so that they can see his character. He brings them to the edge of the Red Sea. He's setting up a test. He rescues them at the Red Sea. He's showing them his character. So he sets the test up. He passes the test. These are the witnesses that God has set up as the children of Israel are going through the desert. Okay, but they did not keep the covenant of God. They refused to walk in his law. Okay, like I said before, this happened before the Mosaic covenant. So what they're talking, the covenant they're talking about here is the Abrahamic covenant. And here is a good portion, I'm about to read to you, of what the Abrahamic covenant entails. The Lord said to Abraham, know for certain that for 400 years, there again, there's the number I was looking for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the 4th generation, your descendants will come back here. So this is part of the promise that God makes to Abraham. And when they refuse to walk in the covenant, what they're doing is they're rejecting this part of God's story. Bob has talked about the word that is translated in our Bibles mostly law, and that word is Torah. And he's said that that could be translated as instruction. It also holds the idea of story. So when God gives instruction, his instruction reflects his character. Like the Ten Commandments, You know, this is not just thou shalt not do this. This is my character. God says, thou shalt not kill because I am life. Thou shalt not tell a lie. Thou shalt not bear false witness because I am the truth. These are witnesses of God's character. So this is a story of God. And when the Israelites reject this part of the covenant, they are rejecting God's story. They are refusing to walk in God's story. Verse 11 and 12, they forgot his works, the wonders that he had shown them, the marvelous things that he did in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt, in the field of Zoan. Okay, they have forgotten at this point in Massa, they have forgotten all the saving acts that God has done for them. But they sinned even more. I skipped the red part. So the next verses are the description of God's rescue from Egypt. And this is the description of the Red Sea rescue. But they sinned even more against him by rebelling against the Most High in the wilderness. They tested God in their hearts by asking for food of their fancy. Yes, they spoke against God, saying, can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rock so that waters gushed out and the streams overflowed. But can he give bread also? Can he provide meat for his people? So they're questioning. They did not believe that God could do this. They didn't trust that he could continue to do saving acts on their behalf. They did not believe and they did not trust in his salvation. Now we have a description of God's care in the desert. Yet he had commanded the clouds above and opened the doors of heaven. He had rained down manna on them to eat and given them the bread of heaven. Men ate angels' food. This is not a pile of gooey dough. This is ambrosia that they're eating. He sent them food to the full. They had more than they needed. He also rained meat on them like dust, feathered fowl like the sand of the seas. And he let them fall in the midst of their camp. So they didn't have to go out and hunt. They didn't have to look for them all around their dwellings. So they ate and were well filled. He gave them their own desire. They were not deprived of their craving. But their heart was not steadfast with him. They were not faithful to his covenant. Again and again, they tested God. They limited the Holy One of Israel. I'm going to get back to that idea of limiting here in a minute. They did not remember his power, the day when he redeemed them from the enemy, when he worked his signs in Egypt and his wonders in the field of Zoan. Okay, do you see that that ties back to verses 11 and 12? We have the not remembering and we have the signs in Egypt and even the exact field talking about. So that's kind of a parallel there. If you look at the whole chapter, you can pick out lots of parallels like that. And here's a parallel into just the part that we're looking at. So they did not remember. They kept forgetting that God had done all this stuff for them. Now, remembering is kind of important. God was so interested in the children of Israel remembering his saving acts that he set up a yearly festival called the Passover so that they would not forget his saving acts coming out of Egypt. It's important for us to remember what God has done in our life, especially in light sometimes of what he doesn't do. So he didn't give the Israelites dessert. They had their bread, they had their meat. They didn't have their cheesecake. They didn't have their chocolate sundaes. Okay, so this is what they're looking for, and they count it as nothing that God could give them bread and that God could give them meat because they didn't have exactly what they wanted. A couple of years ago, I sat down and wrote some things from my story with working with the medical team down in California. And I was going to read a portion of that to you today, and I got it out and was reading it over, and I decided I couldn't do it. But I will tell you a little bit about what I was thinking when I wrote it. So when we went down there, it was a quick decision. Like, we decided on April, March 28th to go, and we were there by April 2nd. So very fast decision. We needed a place to stay. Somebody called up and said, hey, if you need a place to stay, as long as you need to. We needed a car. that same camp, Mount Hermon, called up and said, hey, we'll let you use a car. We needed food while we were there. I would open the door and there would be a box of food on my doorstep. We needed I can't even tell you all the stuff we needed. We needed plane tickets to get there. Somebody called up and said, I work for the airlines. Here's first class tickets, and here's tickets for all your family for whenever they need to use them. Over and over, things like that happened. While we were there, every day, cards by the dozen of people telling Ted how they had touched how he had touched their lives, and gifts of money. And one thing that was really funny about the gifts of money was people would send us cash because they said, well, we know that you can't cash checks when you're away from home. But the funny thing was that during COVID, none of the stores were taking cash. So I had this buildup of cash that I kept stashed in one of the dresser drawers. And I guess God knew this about me, was that when I looked at that cash, I'm like, God is taking care of me. So I had this remembrance, this pile of cash that was a remembrance that God was taking care of us. But things would happen. Some of the things that would happen were like pretty important. Like Ted went through a phase where he stopped sleeping. And so we sent out on Facebook, we sent out, please pray for Ted to get some sleep, because it's important. I mean, it was really super important. We would have had to have stopped the treatments if he couldn't sleep. So we sent this out on Facebook, and 2,000 people hit the like button. 2,000 people around the world were praying for Ted to get some sleep. That was the worst night of my entire life. He never slept. And it was like bad things happened. So the next day, I was looking at my Bible, and I was trying to pay attention to what it was saying, and I couldn't do it. And finally, I closed it up, and I put it aside, and I said, I am not talking to you anymore, God. You are not listening to me. You're not paying attention to me. What do I have to do to get your attention? I forgot. I forgot all of the things. I'm in the house that was given to us. I would climb in the car that was given to us. I would get on the freeway and drive 45 miles on a freeway that should have taken 2.5 hours to get where I was going. Not a single car. God took the cars off the freeway for us. I forgot. And even now, when I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I start remembering all this stuff, I have to like physically take myself by the scruff of the neck and go, remember what God did for you. It's so important for us to not forget and to accuse God of not caring or of not taking care of us, rejecting his story for us by forgetting all the things that he's done for us. So that might have been a little bit more detailed than I had intended to give you, but sorry. So again and again, they tested God. They didn't remember his power when he redeemed them from the enemy. And then we have some verses more about God's rescue from Egypt. And this is about the plagues in Egypt and how God protected them from those. And then, yet they tested and provoked the Most High. They did not give heed to his witnesses. So again and again, they would not accept the things that God was doing for them because they weren't specific to what they wanted. They rejected his saving acts. They said, this is not good enough. We need something better. So this idea of limiting God, this is in the center of the ideas in this particular psalm, the idea of testing and limiting God. And from our perspective, when we ask for a particular miracle, if you do this, God, if you heal, think what great things could happen. Think what the world will see if you could heal this person. This could be such a great testimony to your power. And we think that we are expanding God's horizons. We think because the miracles are outside of our experience that we're offering God a new way to reach into humanity. But what we're actually doing is saying this: if you do this one thing, We're setting the terms for our acceptance of what God can do that we'll take as a sign. We are giving God boundaries. We are limiting God. We will only accept this one thing. We won't accept anything else besides this one thing. That's very limiting to God. I had a friend. I still have a friend. She's still my friend. I have a friend who her son-in-law was very, very badly injured and should have died. Basically, should have died. The family got together and my friend prayed this prayer. She said, God, we want a complete healing from you and we won't accept anything less. Now, I could go with the complete healing part, but when she said, we won't accept anything less, I was like, oh dear. Well, he was healed. Practically a complete healing. And very definitely a miracle. So God was okay with that. All right, but man, I sure wouldn't. in light of Psalm 78, I sure wouldn't do that. So limiting God. Very careful when we're praying for a specific thing, and often we pray, please let this happen, but if it's your will, then we'll accept it. If it's not your will. And a lot of times I'm like, yeah, that's kind of a weak prayer, da da da. But it's not really, you know. It's what we're saying. We're not going to limit God. I will remember your other saving acts. So, the children of Israel, they had seen his character, the plagues, the rescue at the Red Sea, the bread, the meat, the water. God had sent all those to them at Massa, and they still were rejecting him. So I came up with this by accident, but I'm really proud of it. I have three R's for you. You know how preachers, they choose words that start with the same letter so that you can remember them. And I'm like, I wrote my three down and I'm like, oh, that's really cool. So here they are. The testing at Massa represents this. First of all, the children of Israel, they rejected his salvation. God saved them from Egypt. He saved them in the desert. He walked them through. They got to Jordan and they still turned back toward Egypt, even at the Jordan River. They rejected his salvation, his story of salvation. They refused a relationship with him. Instead, they tried to control God. They tried to tell him what to do and how he should be doing it. And they regarded God's power as nothing. They regarded it as not good enough. So now we're going to take those three R's and we're going to jump to Luke 4:12, where Jesus answers the devil and says, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. Now this is not Jesus telling Satan not to tempt him. This is Jesus telling Satan why he, Jesus, won't put God to the test. If Jesus were to follow Satan's advice, he would be rejecting God's plan of salvation just like the children of Israel did. So if he jumped and the people that were all there saw him, they would say, this is the Messiah. This would be the salvation of Israel, but it would be at the expense of the rest of the world. This is not God's plan. This is limiting God to just that one thing. Satan was wrong about God's plan. Jesus is not merely Israel's Messiah. Bob last week read us this verse, Isaiah 49:6. It is too small a thing. It is too limiting a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles that my salvation may reach the ends of the earth. So Satan says, because you're the Son of God, you should do these things, and that will prove it. So if Jesus makes this demonstration of jumping off the high point of the temple, he will gain Jewish followers, but he will lose the world. Jesus responds to the flaw in the devil's argument by saying, this is not how the Son of God acts. This is not what sonship means, to do this thing. So he redefines the idea of sonship in this particular test as remembering God's power. The Son of God, the children of God, all of us, remember God's power. trusting in the salvation plan. There was a plan in place. Jesus knew the plan. He was trusting in that plan and keeping steadfast and faithful to God. So let's pray. Dear God, we thank you that Jesus did not jump and limit himself to just setting up another empire with Israel at the head of it. And please help us remember from day to day the saving acts that you've done for Israel and the saving acts in our own lives and the saving acts that you have in your story for the rest of the world. As we move forward into what looks like more and more turbulent times, let us remember that it's not empire, but it's the kingdom of heaven that we reside in. In your name, amen.